Welcome to Negotiating Ideas. My name is Omar Sadr and I am Senior Research Scholar at the University of Pittsburgh. In this podcast, I spoke with Lior Stranfield on the crisis in the American campuses about the Hamas attack on Israel on October 7th and the subsequent war in Gaza. We talked about how universities, scholars, intellectuals should encounter these events, the key pitfall of both the left and right stance on Israel and Palestine conflict, what these events tell us about moral and ideological tensions in the US. And finally, we also spoke about Israeli politics. Lior is professor of history and Jewish study at Penn State University in the US. He is a social historian of modern Middle East with a particular interest in the histories of Jewish people and other minorities in the region. His first book, titled Between Iran and Zion, Jewish Histories of 20th Century Iran, examines the development and integration of Jewish communities in Iran into the national building project of the last century. On to the podcast. All right, Lior, good morning and welcome to Negotiating Ideas.
Good morning, pleasure to be here.
It has been almost 7 weeks since October 7th, the horrible attack on civilians in Israel. And the war is going on now in Gaza with lots of casualties. I am interested to talk to you because you're a professor of history of Jews, but at the same time you're studying Jews of outside Israel, Iran. I think you were the best option to speak about the current controversies which is happening around American universities since October 8th, the very first reactions which emerged from Harvard University and later on Columbia and many other campuses. So it has been quite difficult for people to think through all of these events. To digest them, but lots of also polarization, ups and downs. Definitely you are also following all of these. So my first question to you would be, how do you see the current status in academia, particularly United States, where you teach? And how probably another question, if I also join it, is how academia should encounter such kind of incidents?
So let me start by saying that we are in a moment that is calling for intellectual leadership. The situation on campuses has been difficult for a while. When it comes to Israel-Palestine, it was never easy. It was never easy to teach the courses on Israel-Palestine, the Middle East in general. And there was a lot of policing of language and policing of, almost of denying academic freedoms for people who work on Israel and Palestine. And this led to delegating a lot of the cultural and intellectual activities around Israel-Palestine to advocacy organizations like Hillel or other pro-Israel group and the Students for Justice in Palestine or the Palestine Solidarity Movement on the other side. Both groups can and should exist on campus. I don't think that they don't have place, and I encourage students to be active, but I also think that if students can have the opportunity to be active, but out of being informed, so they go to the classrooms, they study the history of the conflict, the history of the movements, everything that is around it, their activism will be much more precise and much more disciplined. And this is something that, unfortunately, is not the case today. And this is why you see, I think that this is one of the reasons why you see such emotional conversation, or not conversation, just protest and polarization on campuses.
Sure. So your point is that we cannot ban activism in universities, but definitely these should be informed, well-taught kind of stances. But I mean, one of the angles of this controversy is also about the limits of freedom of speech. And even before October 7, the controversy over the limits of freedom of speech existed in universities. Earlier, it was the right which was concerned about why there are so much censorship, but now it is the left who's complaining that there is a limit, there is a censorship in this. How do you see the shift of the position between right
so
and left?
This is a very good question. I think that we have to analyze. What does it mean? What kind of critique the right wing offered versus what kind of critique the left wing offered? I can say from my campus at Penn State, when an alt-right fascist wanted to come to speak on campus, it created a lot of chaos. The university allowed it in the name of free speech. But this is someone who is homophobic, anti-Semitic. There's no espoused, fascist and Nazi ideas openly. This is the kind of free speech that we have to discuss. What are the boundaries of it? But the cap on free speech on the left is you are not allowed to say that you're supporting, Palestinian liberation. I mean, Palestinian liberation can mean many things. Mm. But the basic idea is that, on campuses, this is something that can cost people their academic position sometimes.
Definitely.
I want to say something because it's related, and I think that it will make it will make it clear.
Sure.
There is the definition of anti-Semitism that is very prevalent in the U.S. that was put forth by the IHRA, and this is this definition of anti-Semitism. Says that every critique of Israel is a form of anti-Semitism. Hmm. And this is where it becomes limiting free speech, because we should be able, especially in institutions of higher learning, we should be able to make the distinction between criticizing Israel or Israeli policies and being anti-Semitic. And when we don't have the boundaries, every form of critique on Israel is anti-Semitism, then you have what you have in place is policing language and policing ideas.
That's right. So I think this issue has been come up with within political science scholarship also. And I think recently scholars like Joshua Monk, who has written a book, Identity Trap, he argues that the left increasingly has defined the boundaries of freedom of speech based on certain identity issues like race. And for example, what we define as racism or what we define as anti-racist kind of a stance has been too rigid and defined in a quite binary manner. That either you're anti-racist or you are racist. So you have to take a stance, and that somehow this kind of boundary standpoints does not allow plurality on one hand, and at the same time does not allow those who are neutral or those probably who are in the process of thinking to also exist. And I just read a few days ago a stance which was out by academic freedom, American academic freedom, which expressed that, of course, faculties and professors has a right to take a stance on political issues. But when it comes to classroom and when it comes to universities, where they have captive students' audience, they should not push for a certain form of indoctrination and certain form of ideology. So the question is, it's a very thin line how a professor as a citizen should have an opinion, political stance, but at the same time should also observe that neutrality.
I agree. First of all, I think that people overestimate professors if they think that professors can indoctrinate students. We are no longer talking about captive audiences. Students choose to go to classes, but I absolutely agree that indoctrination is not what we are here to do. Mm-hmm. But again, we have to see, like, in real terms, what does it mean when, and this is critique that comes from the right, right? We have to say, what does it mean to indoctrinate students? And every time that I try to understand, like, it, to get real examples, it comes up with, you know, something that I'll give you an example. That a few years ago there was this controversy about indoctrination, and it ended up being like critiquing. It was in Department of Economics, I think at NYU. I don't remember exactly. Don't catch me on that. And the indoctrination was critique of capitalism, was taken as indoctrination to left wing,
right,
ideologies, sure, which is nonsense.
Yeah.
Critique of everything should be part of our universe, everyday life. It should be part of every breath we take.
True.
So we have to be very careful also with that. And back then, I think during the heat of the moment, someone wrote on Twitter, I can't even make my students read. How do you expect me to indoctrinate them?
yeah. Sure, but I'm interested also to know about what do you think about taking a stance on such kind of political issues? And one form of taking a stance is, of course, forming associations or a form of solidarity groups who are coming, people are coming, scholars, students are coming together and writing joint statements. So at this point of crisis, on the one hand, we do need solidarity. We do need to collectively take actions. But at the same time, I also understand there are those who are against writing such letters. A good article which came from this standpoint is written, I mean, at early November it came, on the letters were written by Roger Brickwitz on the Hannah Arendt Center for Politics and Humanities, where he argues that these letters are kind of easy stances that people may take. And at the same time, these letters prevent plurality of ideas because it emphasizes on only one stance. So on one hand, Hannah Arendt herself may argue that taking political stance and showing solidarity as part of politics, collective action is part of politics. But at the same time, here also we have other constancy who may argue against it. So what is your take on that?
I think that I don't believe in the idea of the apolitical professor. I think that we are all political people. If you are part of the society and you feel strongly about either topic, you should be out there and talk about it. You don't. If someone takes the letters and bring it to the classroom, either as some kind of putting expectation of for the student to respond to it, this is wrong. But if I write, if I sign a statement that I feel strongly about a situation, a political situation, and it's important for me to express it. We have a role. Our role is not only within the classroom. We have a role within our communities, and we have an aspect of public service in our profession. And this is, I would say, this is almost our duty to be involved and to be active and to speak up. And it doesn't mean that speaking up should be to one side or the other, but being involved is something that I think informs our, our personality. It's not that. Unfortunately, the reality in the past decades forces us to take stands many times, too many times. But this is something, so we have to make a separation between activism, whether on campus or in our community, and bringing it to the classroom. Bringing it to the classroom is not something that I want to see. Sure. But being out there and show, look, I tell my students, for example, every time before Elections Day, yeah. I tell my students that I expect them to vote. I want them to vote. I don't care who they vote for. I yeah. want them to be there and to vote, because people in other parts of the world are willing to die while trying to get the right to vote.
That's right.
I want them to be active. I want them to be engaged with the everyday, with the community, with the sure. With the future of our country.
Sure, sure. What I struck with one of your earlier remarks, that campuses do need all sorts of political solidarity movements from those who are pro-Palestinians in Harvard, for example, or the others who are opposite. I think the, amongst faculty also, even before October 7, the polarization was in a sense that some departments were celebrating, oh, well, now we are pure Democrats. We don't have any Republicans amongst ourselves, or probably that way. Some disciplines has been quite extreme, like political science to a certain extent it has remained neutral, but sociology and anthropology has always been on the left. Economics has always been on the right. So how do you see this balance, or how your faculty should also bring this balance?
Look, you have to see the nature of disciplines like sociology. Sociology is a critical discipline as part of its nature, as part of its DNA. It's critiquing of social structures. So people who tend to be more critical of existing social structures, it makes sense that they form their political opinion that would adhere to the left. It's not something that it's not, you know, you probably can find a sociologist on the right, but it's not something just the same way that economics grew to become like venue economics and law and business school. These are professions that are considered to be more right-leaning. History, for example, my discipline is mixed. It's not, there's no, the politics don't necessarily shape the professional profile. And political science has many right-wing scholars and left-wing scholars. I think that the extremes would be economics and sociology. And by the way, I would love to see more left-wing scholars on in econ department and more right-wing scholars in sociology.
Okay, so taking a stance as an individual, a scholar or intellectual, of course, that should not be prohibited. But the fact is that universities and institutions, whether they should take a political stance or not. And in this regard, for example, the report in 1967 by Professor Henry Colvin of University of Chicago, which happened at the controversy of Vietnam War and civil rights movement. It said, for example, that university is the home of critiques and it is not itself the critique. So that means that it should, if it takes a stance, that will be against plurality of opinions and ideas. Anyway, but let's come to that definition of anti-Semitic that you provided earlier, which was quite narrow, any critique of Israel, which is an state. And of course, you can be critique of the policies, the ideology, the politicians, but the definition of anti-Semitism is as narrow as it limits any kind of dissent, for example, within Israel. Probably any Jew who himself is a citizen of Israel and critique that will be problematic. So what would be an appropriate definition in that case for you?
So a few years ago, a group of scholars gathered and wrote the Jerusalem Declaration, which is an alternative to the IHRA working definition of anti-Semitism. And it is much more careful and nuanced in defining what is anti-Semitism. And so you know, blaming the Jews for spreading COVID-19 is anti-Semitic, but but saying that the occupation is illegal and should be, you know, acted against, it's not anti-Semitic.
Yeah.
The differences between the between the documents cannot be clearer. It's one of them is trying to basically ban all kinds of critique, and one of them is trying to say anti-Semitism is a real danger, but we have to understand what we're fighting against. You cannot just say that, you know, any kind of expression against Israeli occupation or for the BDS movement or against or saying that Israel is an apartheid state, whether it's true or not, this cannot be a form of anti-Semitism.
People should have the liberty to express if they, for example, say X and Y state as an apartheid state, and they provide the rationale probably for it. Yeah. And now let's move to the academia and Israel. So there's so much focus in American academia, but how is this moral and ideological tension as following October 7 and current war in Gaza is unfolding in Israeli universities?
So first of all, the academic year in Israel has not started. It was about to open in mid-October, and it was delayed because of the war, and now it's scheduled to open on December 24th. The universities were very badly impacted. Many students, especially in the institutions in the south, lost students who died in the massacre of October 7th, faculty, staffers. Everyone in Israel is impacted, and the universities have been badly impacted. And the responses, I think responses have been from all over, the spectrum. Some urge, you know, supported the military response of the IDF in Gaza. Others try to oppose it. I would say that the opposing voices, unfortunately, are fewer than the voices in support of the attack. I should say that I'm now in Israel. This is I'm a Penn State professor, but I'm on research leave in Israel right now, so. You know, obviously the official stand of the universities was condemnation, unequivocal condemnation of the Hamas attack, but there wasn't any clear response to the war that followed it.
Sure.
And
does it somehow now this reflects overall Israeli society, where following October 7, there was a kind of national unity? Of course, national unity government came into being. Everyone say that, okay, this is a moment that we should unite and take one stance. But also it has been quite long, almost two to three decades, that Israeli left has not emerged as strong as it should be. So you have a strong centrist, but also the current government, Likud, who has very radical right politicians, and it's a coalition of very far right politicians. So what is the vibe in Israeli politics? Of course, before October 7, everyone was focusing not on Palestinian peace or war, but and what was going on and politically with the Prime Minister Netanyahu's unconstitutional move. So, I mean, there is no left, and everyone has come towards quite extreme right. Where Israeli society is moving?
The Israeli society is moving to the right. It has been in. You first stated that the Israeli left is not as strong as it should be. And then you restated that there is no Israeli left, and this is more accurate. There is no Israeli left. The Israeli left is now maybe 15 seats out of 120 in the Knesset, in the parliament. Everything else is center-right to the far-right.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's the war is not going to change to the other way. The Israeli public has been overwhelmingly supporting the military response, the war after October 8th. I'm trying to be optimistic and to see how the left can reemerge from the ruins of this war, and I think that there is possibility. I think that people understand that the status quo is not viable anymore.
Mm.
And maybe from this understanding, something can come up.
Sure. It really strikes me because history tells us something different. Israel, at the beginning when it was formed, it supported anti-apartheid movement in South Africa. It was something that the United States didn't expect Israel to do that. And Israeli move left was quite strong in early years, but it went down. So, I mean, what is the cause of that failure? Probably one is, of course, many scholars argue it's because of the failure of the peace process to take momentum. It has been almost two decades that nothing is happening. So everyone has lost their faith on peace. Or there's something more to that?
There is a lot more. So the Mapai, the Labour Party, ruled from 1948 to 1977. You say that Israel opposed South African apartheid. It's partly true because Israel was only one of, I think, four countries that eventually supported South Africa in the UN. Together with the U.S. and I can't remember who else. So it wasn't a moral standpoint that was kept throughout the decades. And so the Labour Party ruled for three decades, and it became like every party that would rule for so long, it became a very corrupt party, and the Likud party was taken as a clean alternative, something of we need to remove the hegemony and the corruption of the Labour Party, so we'll give the chance to the Likud party. The Likud, this will be oversimplistic, but the Likud in the first years, Menachem Begin, the prime minister, signed a peace agreement with Egypt, which was very, very popular. He was able to make the first territorial concession when he gave the Sinai Peninsula back to Egypt. He later got into the war in Lebanon that lasted until the year 2000. So this is... Until the late 1980s, there was the feeling that the Palestinians and the occupation can just be ignored. Mm. There was no price to pay for that.
Mm.
And in 1987, the first Intifada started, and then the Israeli public, for the first time, felt that there is a price to pay for the occupation and the control over the Palestinians. And then there was the movement to the left again. And Yitzhak Rabin was elected in 1992, basically to make peace with the Palestinians. And we saw the Oslo Accord that it was popular in the beginning, but then in 1994, Hamas started to to send suicide bombers and terror attacks inside Israel, and this so the peace process became less popular because now there was a price to pay for the peace process. And on that, on the heels of on the heels of that one, Benjamin Netanyahu was first elected in 1996, and he always said that his mission is to kill the Oslo Accords. Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated in 1995, November 1995. The elections in May 1996, Netanyahu won by very slim, the slightest majority. In the beginning, because of the pressure from the Clinton administration, he proceeded with the Oslo Accords. But, you know, the Oslo Accords also said that a Palestinian state should be established by 1999. We all know that it didn't happen. So, and then the second intifada broke out when Ehud Barak, the head of then the head of the Labor Party, won. And so the responsibility again on the second intifada and the failure of the peace process also fell on the shoulders of the so-called left, right? And since then we had only right-wing governments. So from 2001, it's been Ariel Sharon and Ehud Olmert and then Netanyahu until now, with a short break for Bennett and Lapid for 1 year in the middle. So we don't see, we see the movement only to one side. We don't see correction to the other side.
So what I was referring in 1950s and 60s as a Israel support for the anti-apartheid movement is a few couple of incidents. First of all, in 1962, Israel voted a General Assembly of United Nations resolution, which strongly condemned apartheid and called for voluntary sanctions against South Africa. And in 1963, Israel boycotted boycotted sending ammunition to South Africa, but also established a formal relationship with the African National Congress. Anyway, but you're right, because there was also, because of a Jewish community in South Africa, it was quite difficult for as far as Israel to convince those people. Am I right on that?
Look, the Jewish community in South Africa was not a monolith, right? And many of the South African Jews actually participated in the struggle against apartheid. Okay. And they were far more to the left than most of most other white South Africans. You know, people like Joe Slovo, that in Mandela's government became a minister. He was the most senior Jewish member of the African National Congress. So, but you know, the kind of foreign policy that you describe is typical for Israel in the 60s and 70s, trying to make as many friends as possible. And it there was some duality there, but Israel didn't have a good record on human rights with diplomatic relations, in regards to diplomatic relations.
So now if we move on to the current status, what's going on in Gaza, I suppose there is no clear roadmap and a strategic thinking about what should happen after this war. Of course, we don't have any clarity on when the war will come to an end, but where is, Israeli society again on this issue, how Gaza should be administered? Of course, there are several ideas floating around globally and international level. But since the government is a coalition of far right, I suppose there is not much interest in transferring administration of Gaza back to a Palestinian authority or anyone else.
So the government, Netanyahu, did not provide any clear vision for the goals of the war or what's going to be with Gaza, you know, the next day. The right wing, the far right, and I would say even closer to the circles of the Likud party, they have this dream, the fantasy of reestablishing the settlements of the Gaza Strip that were evacuated in 2005. I hope that it's not a realistic goal. We see that Netanyahu changed his position, at least at least in towards the press, when he was asked a few days ago if the PA, the Palestinian Authority, will be allowed in. He said no, but then Biden said yes, and then Netanyahu said, okay, we may consider it. The Israeli public doesn't have, I mean, there's no public conversation on what should be the future of Gaza right now. And it's tragic because this is a conversation that we need to have from the before we went to the war, not just not now. And the humanitarian crisis in Gaza is unbearable. We see there are over 1.5 million internal refugees right now in the southern Gaza Strip. I don't know if there's any thinking of how to rebuild Gaza, which is this is a conversation that we need to have now. Mm. How do we rebuild Gaza? How do we create international coalition with the Arab countries, with the EU, with the US to create this kind of international support and reassure and making sure that Gaza doesn't fall, you know. We have, again, unfortunately, from the past 20 years, we have too many examples for toppling a bad regime just to get something worse.
Yeah.
So Afghanistan, as you well know, and Iraq, and Hamas, is bad, but if we don't make sure that it transitions into something that Gaza is transitioned into, you know, something more stable and solid, I don't think that Hamas is the worst we've seen.
Sure. Do you think this is a moment that we should really push for the two-state solutions? Because I think as the crisis requires an alternative in Gaza, so that should be a moment for two states.
I think that the two-state solution, at least as a transitional phase, is very good. We have to think about what does it mean very good. The only thing that I cannot see happening is the current situation. I think that the separation between Gaza and the West Bank is bad. I think that the siege over Gaza is bad. I think that not moving to finalizing kind of agreement of settlement between Israel and Palestine is bad. I think that the Palestinian Authority not being a state is bad. So everything that would, anything that would change the current status quo is preferable over this. So it's the one state, democratic state, some kind of confederacy between Israel and Palestine, two-state solution. I'm now open to anything, but we have to move fast. We cannot let any vacuum to be born out of this crisis.
Right. And probably if I ask you a last question back to the first issues that we discussed, how do you imagine American or all academia, I mean, in general, whether it's an American or Israeli or other Middle Eastern Arab Muslims, how academia should take stance or in general should react to such kind of horrible incidents, which is a matter of life and death for humanity. It's both Israelis, Jews, but also the Palestinians and Muslims.
We have to foster honest conversations we have to allow the public debate to take place in our campuses. I don't know. I don't have any good, you know, good policies or good advice for universities other than encourage teaching. The moment that we gave up as a society on the liberal arts, we gave up on our ability to discuss, to analyze, to argue, and we see the outcomes of it in our, you know, in the U.S. Domestic discourse, and also when it comes to foreign issues. We have to learning, studying other cultures make us more open-minded and more aware and better global citizens. And this is what the universities should be doing.
And on that note, I think we come to the end of this conversation. Truly grateful for your time and insight. I really enjoyed talking to you. And I'm sure our audience will enjoy listening to you.
Thank you very much.
And finally, thanks to our audience. If you like this podcast and this episode, please make sure to share it with your colleagues and circles. Looking forward to connecting with you back next month.